Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist.
Hi, Laura. I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Getting ready for the holiday.
Me too. All the Thanksgiving prep, and then I have been knee-deep in Christmas DVD, a new project that I'm working on. So, boy, do I feel like I'm in the spirit, but I'm already exhausted and think, oh, this hasn't even started yet. But I'm really excited about the new... What'd you say? Tip of the iceberg.
Iceberg, yes.
I know. So are you having guests for Thanksgiving?
We are having Bill's parents, and Laura's coming home supposedly tonight, but she's not here yet. So, yeah.
We are just having the five of us plus one of our son's girlfriends, and then they will go to her family's after us, and then this week I'm going to be wrapping up that new DVD of mine, which, have we talked about that on the show at all?
I don't think so.
I'm going to talk about it a little bit tonight because I'm so excited about it, and then I hope that next week it's finished and for sale, and I can really talk about it then, but it's a new DVD that I'm doing, and because after every DVD that I've done, until now, I always get emails from parents that say, my child learned how to talk watching your DVD, and, you know, that was never the intention with any of those earlier projects because those are for adults to watch and then know how to work with their children. And this DVD serves that purpose, too, but it's also been specifically designed so that kids can watch and I'm using the same play routines that we talk about week after week after week, and with a Christmas theme, and again, it's based on the hierarchy of teaching vocal imitation to children, and it's very simple and very repetitive, which is what research tells us children need to really learn when they are watching DVDs versus, and we've talked about this a lot on here, how lots of the educational DVDs are so fast-paced and they're not slow enough for children to process and they're focused on objects rather than people. And we know kids learn how to talk from people. So I'm just super, super excited about it and it's all coming together. And I've been working on it for about a month maybe. And so it's very exciting that, and I'm just praying we get it done in time for Christmas so that it can be available. So that's just my little spiel, and we'll talk about that next week some more when it's officially done and ready and available. But I've been talking to you about it for about a month, so probably longer, probably 6 or 8 weeks by now. So I love it when it starts to really come together and your ideas kind of spring forward and have a life of their own and you see your hard work paying off. So it's been very, very exciting.
Well, I think they're going to be really cool and very beneficial. So, you know, both you and I are not big advocates of stick a kid in front of a TV or in front of a video, but the truth is, the reality is, a lot of kids do watch television, so if they're going to watch it anyway, I think it's wonderful that there'll be something that will really benefit them, because I have a lot of moms who think, well, I'll do Sesame Street, I'll do, you know, some quote-unquote learning thing, and I'm not knocking those shows. I think they all have their place and they could be great, but I don't think those are shows that kids who are language delayed watch and pick up much language. You know what I mean? They're entertained, but they're not really learning what I would like them to be learning. So I think it's going to be awesome that there will be something out there that really is beneficial to kids with language delays, and I know you're the one to do it.
So sweet. I'm excited about it. And the other thing is, too, that adults can watch, and the main purpose of this is for an adult to watch with a child and then see when their interest is piqued and their eyes light up and they start to really want to play with something, and that's another purpose on the back of, and this will turn into a series, but we'll just have the Christmas one available immediately. And the toy list is going to be on there so the adult can gather a few things and play with the child, and hopefully it be a springboard for real live interaction so that the adult can carry over the play routines and carry over the script, for lack of a better word, because sometimes parents don't know exactly what you would say to really facilitate early speech and language. And again, with a typically developing kid, you don't really have to pay as much attention to that because language just happens. It evolves. It's almost like magic when you start to see a typically developing kid really start to, you know, that they're understanding what words mean, and then they start to imitate those words and link meaning with those words. But with our guys that we work with, our language delayed friends, it's not always that easy. You can't just sit with them and play and think it will automatically happen, because the truth is, if it were going to happen that way and be that easy, it would have already happened. They wouldn't need services, or they would not have been identified as having a delay, or even before a parent really realizes it's a big deal, they wouldn't be missing those milestones already. So this is a way, too, for adults to watch and say, oh, okay.
That's what I should be doing.
She's saying the same word over and over and over, and she's using, and again, this is based on the hierarchy that I teach in my conferences and how kids learn to imitate actions and gestures and imitate play routines, and then the words start to come. So it's based on all that science that we talk about and that we use in our therapy sessions, too. So I think it'll be really beneficial for parents and for professionals as well to really take a look at those things and analyze how do my play routines look compared to this? And, again, taking the kids out of it where it's just not so much focused on what the kid is doing, where I'm just there doing the play routine, that might make it a little easier for some parents to understand and think, okay, this is my role. I need to do it like this. So, again, I didn't really mean to talk about it this long, but super excited about it. Next week we'll probably talk about it more and when I have everything ready to roll out. So that's very exciting. Other announcements, my Lexington conference is on for Friday, December 2nd. If you have not registered and you live in Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, I have some people coming from Michigan. When I started looking at registrations, I got really excited about that. So last conference of the year, I'd love for anyone to join me who hasn't gotten a chance. This will be the last time I do this conference, probably in Kentucky. It's the only date on my schedule for 2011 through 2012. So join me if you are inclined to do that. I'd love to have you there. And I think those are the only real announcements.
Are you waiting for me to say something?
No, I was listening to Johnny. He was saying, say that you're not speaking at Kisha. I'm not speaking at Kisha. There were scheduling issues. I think I said that last week, but maybe, I don't know. All right, moving right along. Let's talk about, this is part 4 in our series on social skills that a toddler needs before he is developmentally ready to learn to use language. And we've spent the last 3 shows talking about that list of skills and what we look for, what the milestone is, and how we measure that, and how we talk to parents about it if the skill is not there. And we've also talked about therapy-wise things that we do to elicit those skills or elicit better participation. And even when a child is using some self-stimulatory behaviors, we spent the whole last show, the last 2 shows, talking about self-stimulatory behaviors or stereotypical behaviors and what those are and what those look like and the things that we can know about a child when he's using those kinds of behaviors and what that tells us that his sensory system is like. And last week we spent the entire show talking about if we see a particular behavior in a child and how we use that to plan activities that will hopefully elicit better engagement and better interaction in those kids. And so if you're just joining us for this series, it may make a little more sense for you to hop off this show and back up to part one of this series and then work your way forward so that you have all the background information. And I'm hoping that we get through the rest of the list tonight, but I think I've said that for this will be the fourth week in a row to say that.
It may be the never-ending topic. Well, all of them kind of blend together anyway.
It could be.
Go off on these tangents, so get really extended.
Well, and the most important thing is we want to talk about what the skill is, what it looks like, what a kid looks like when he's not exhibiting the skill. Because, again, sometimes we'll say to a parent, I'm really worried about your child's social skills. And the mom says, what are you talking about? He's social. And then we don't pursue it. We don't say, well, actually, if we're measuring these things, these are the issues that I'm concerned about. These things tell me that his social skills are not what we would expect them to be for a child his age. And then I always carry that over to say, no wonder he's not talking as well, or no wonder he's not understanding language as well, because he's missing the prerequisite. He's missing the foundation, which is that social interaction piece. So we're talking about those things, and then we hopefully will go beyond that to talk about the kinds of things that we do to elicit the specific social skill that we want to see, and the kinds of things that have worked with us in therapy sessions with children over these past, it feels like a bazillion years, but it's really not. So anyway, okay, moving right along. Tonight we're talking about the piece that really lets us know that a child is with us and engaged and likes what we're doing, and that's a social response. And by that we're meaning a laugh, a smile that's directed toward us, because so many times, Kate, haven't you seen children who are, again, on the spectrum or will eventually get an autism spectrum diagnosis, and their moms will say, well, he's happy. I don't really think that he's autistic because he does smile. But when you start really watching that child, his happy responses aren't really directed to people. They're usually
right.
directed to an object or maybe a television show, something that he's seen, but it's not a true social response. And I've even had parents, you know, or other people comment about, or a grandmother might say, well, I didn't really think this was a big deal because he's just so happy all the time, and I really didn't think autistic kids ever really showed that kind of emotion. And that would just be a myth, because a lot of times you can look at these kids, and even though they are happy and they are pleasant a lot of the time, again, there's no social response connected with that. When they're smiling maybe or laughing, it's not directed to mommy or daddy or brother or sister or anything else other than something that's triggered that that smile or that response, but it's not social.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times parents, also moms, I guess there's where I see it most because I mostly deal with moms, but they might confuse, a warm bond, a close physical affection that they might share with a child for a social connection. And
right.
to me, it is not at all the same thing. I mean, I see what
right.
they mean. Well, he likes to snuggle with me. He likes to
right.
pet my hair. He likes for me to hold him. He, whatever all those things might be, and although those are significant and real, they are really not particularly social, not anything like the social response we would look for in a typically developing two-year-old. You know, they're supposed to
right.
look at you. They're supposed to listen to you. They're supposed to respond to you. Not every second, nobody's happy 100% of the time, but the kids we're talking about here really just don't have that piece. It's something that we work hard on in therapy to get, you know, and
right.
oftentimes we're able to get it, but it's not something that's easy or natural or automatic for the kids we're talking about now.
You know, and that brings me to another little tangent that I don't think we've talked about on the show in a long time. We certainly haven't talked about in the series, where sometimes a therapist, especially if they are new to early intervention, and they might mistakenly say, I can get his attention and I can get a good social response from him during a therapy session, so that means that he doesn't have autism. And when I hear that, I think, well, if you can't get it, and you're a trained professional who spent thousands of hours and dollars on your education, and hopefully you have some professional experience to back it up, and hopefully you have some instincts for eliciting a response from children, from children, if you can't get that kind of response, you know, that's not, you shouldn't be doing this job, and that's not a diagnostic, that's not part of the criteria. He's not autistic if the speech therapist can make him smile. And sometimes therapists get really confused by that, and sometimes the therapist really doesn't realize that a kid's best hour of the week is when he's in therapy. And again, why wouldn't it be that way? Because she, or he, hopefully are reading the signs that the kid gives and really working to pull that child in, and you're doing fun activities and you're playing and you're using all these things that sometimes we don't even know how to articulate the things that we do with kids. You know, if somebody says, why does that work for you? Sometimes we just go, I don't know, it doesn't work.
They
you know,
like
without
it.
Really, without really being able to articulate, that's my whole art versus science thing. You know, I can teach a lot of people the science part, but sometimes you can't even really describe the art part of what we do. It's hard to really put into words.
Right.
But again, if a therapist can't get that, or if sometimes therapists are really, really fooled and really say, I just didn't think he was on the spectrum because he does so well with me. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of emails about that and had conversations with people about that. And, I early in my career, I even felt that way a time or two myself. Or even lately, I'm thinking of one little boy that I show video of in the conferences. And I stopped seeing him when I started speaking because his day was always when I was going to be out of town, especially last fall. And his OT, who saw him through the time that he was three, said to me, Laura, he never looked as good to me as he looked on your video there. And that really, you know, and she had told me that he had gotten diagnosed. And he was a kid that in my mind, you know, I thought, oh, kind of borderline. But it's still a shock when you really think about that and when you really sometimes have to take a step back and be really objective about kids. And we as therapists, a lot of us, we fall in love with our clients too, and our feelings are almost as hurt as, you know, certainly not the same as a mom, but we've had this conversation, Kate, about kids where they get a diagnosis and we really are depressed.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I certainly have been guilty in recent times, and I think it is that you love them yourself after you know them and have worked with them and, you know, found what's endearing about them, and every kid has something, so by that point, and you do kind of feel a little almost like defensive, like, no, don't, not another, because, I mean, it's just, well, the number of kids being diagnosed, and I think for the most part, rightfully so, unfortunately, you know, I really subscribe to this is an epidemic. There is something seriously wrong with the number of kids that are being, not that I question that they're being diagnosed, just that there are so many more kids.
Yeah, how did this happen? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the numbers are just growing, you know, at such an exponential rate that there is something obviously going on that so many more kids are on the spectrum now. But you do. You love them and you think, please, he's cute, he's doing well, you know, I just can't hear another one get the diagnosis, and you just want to think, no. But, you know, a lot of times with those kids, I mean, no, all the time with those kids, when I do look at it objectively, when they look good is when you're doing your routines, when you're doing the things you have taught them, that they know the script just almost as well as you do. That's when they're smiling, they're laughing, they're, you know, maybe saying the desired targeted words, and you're thinking, woohoo, you know.
Right.
This child couldn't possibly be on the spectrum, and yet if you see them without the script, and by that I mean if you change
the scenario, if the environment changes, whatever, if it's a different setup, they completely fall apart. And you see,
right.
Oh, this isn't something they generalize. This isn't something, you know, it really is
right.
just the things. And they may have some routines with their moms, hopefully, and they may have some
mm-hmm.
routines with grandma. And that's all wonderful, and that is important that you establish those routines and continue to build on them. But it doesn't negate a diagnosis. Yeah,
exactly.
And I've certainly been guilty of thinking, oh, please, no. You know?
I know.
I mean, like, oh.
Yeah.
But
and I remember an email that I got from a therapist that I've gotten to know online. She lives in California. She'll probably hear this show and know I'm talking about her. And she sent me an email, and she said that she was so upset when this child got this diagnosis because she didn't really feel like it was 100% warranted. And the service coordinator said to her, he sounds just like you. He was doing
uh-huh.
what you do when mm-hmm. you when I know that you play with him. And so I wrote her back, and this was right after you and I had had a conversation about a kid that went along that same venue and said, Kate and I were just talking about this, and it does become that they learn to do therapy. And again, that's great. I mean, we certainly have some children that don't get there, and that
right.
we hope and pray we can get them to that point. But when you take all of those supports away, all of those things that we instinctively give children, and we do the play routines, and we know what they like, and we base our activities on keeping their attention, and we do all the things just perfectly that we talk about week after week after week after week, the things that make children more engaged, the things that make them learn to understand language, the things that make them start to pop out those words. When you take all that away, you again, if they're not generalizing, which most of the time, lots of our friends that are this young and on the spectrum, they're not able to do that yet. They really do look like there's a social communication disorder there. And that, and even from a different kind of perspective, have you ever seen one of your kids that you thought were, you know, was doing pretty well at home, but you see them in Target or you see them at the grocery store, and again, out of context, and they have no idea who you are or why you're there.
Yes, I have.
And you start to
happen.
Think,
oh,
yeah.
Which is
yeah.
not really normally a child that age. If you saw them one place, they would respond and say hi or at least smile,
right.
and you'd know. Oh,
right.
They totally knew. Yes, and they look at you like, who are you? What, and it's the same kid who's
right.
so excited when you get to their house to play with them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And yes, that was yes. when I was, you know, when those years that I worked in my church's Wednesday night program so that I could remember that two-year-olds really talk. I hardly saw any of my little friends first, like on Sunday mornings. You know, they would see me on Sundays and they would see me on Wednesday nights. But on Sundays, they would run and find me in the hall. Or they
mm-hmm.
would run up to me and initiate that with me. Or if I happened to see them at Kroger or at Target or wherever, you know, they would light up and immediately almost recognize me before I recognized them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, that just became so obvious to me. And I knew that from an intellectual perspective, and we talk about these things all the time. But when you see it happen time and time again in reality,
mm-hmm.
and some of those kids, it would be kids that I had just maybe only seen a couple of times or, you know,
uh-huh.
three or four times. And then they would start to recognize, you know, I would feel an arm on my leg at church and I would think, well, who is this? You know, and I would try to remember their names because I had only maybe had them in class 2 or 3 weeks. And so, you know, again, really striking difference between a lot of that kind of behavior versus a lot of the kids that we see on our caseload. So, again, just kind of food for thought there that sometimes even as therapists, we get a little too subjective in our opinions. And so I certainly can understand how moms do and how moms feel about that and how moms think, okay, you can't really say he's not social because of all these things that, you know, all the great examples that you gave, he plays with my hair every single night. He comes up and grabs my leg all day long. He pulls me into the kitchen when he wants something. And again, when you take those things away and really look at how he's really responding and really interacting with people, you start to notice those differences. And it's, again, an eye-opener for us a lot of the time. Okay,
you know,
so
the
that,
other thing, Laura, too, is just let me throw this out there, is that a lot of times I've had kids who, well, they may get a diagnosis from one source and then get a, you know, a retraction from another source kind of thing, or maybe they get one sort of a diagnosis. My point is, as they get older, it seems like a very high percentage of the time, those kids who looked mildly on the spectrum or part of the team thought he was, but then the assessment group, you know, if they went for a team assessment, they said no. So often as they get older, there's an eventual diagnosis because what looks a little suspicious or atypical at 2.5, 3 can look quite atypical at 5, 6, or 7. And I've had, the longer I'm around doing this, the more I've had that. I just got a Facebook message from somebody that that's the way it played out. And, I hate to hear it, but yet, and I wasn't convinced he was, but I thought there was that possibility. And he did not get the diagnosis in first steps. And now that he's in school, they're saying they're pretty convinced. And I think, I could see because, you know, if things don't dramatically improve, as I said, what looks a little suspicious at 2.5 or 3 looks quite atypical at 5 or 6 or 7. So
And that's not to say that early intervention doesn't work, because goodness knows we see kids, and a lot of times I'll see a kid at 2 that I'm really pretty despondent about, but by 3 he looks pretty good. And there are children that make so much progress that that's not a concern anymore.
Right.
But for a lot of kids that we see, you're right, the older they get, especially if they've not had a lot of intervention, especially if at 3 their parents decide we're not going to follow through with therapy, he's doing okay now, we're just going to hold our breath and see what happens, or for whatever reason they move, they don't get, you know, the parents decide we're not going to do preschool, you know, again, for whatever real life, very valid reason happens, then those kids show up for kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and do eventually have that suspicion confirmed. So, we see that happen a lot. And it's coming up on Christmas time, and boy, you know, I'll start to get the Christmas cards from parents, and the updates, or start to see a little more people shopping. And the holidays, when I always run into kids that, you know, I'll look at a kid and go, and then I'll look up at his mom and go, I thought I knew you. And you can, you know, the moms look more like themselves when 7 or 8 years ago versus our little friends, because in my mind they always stay 3. You know, the last time I saw them was at their birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we do see that when it happens a lot, even for our kids that, you know, we're still kind of worried about when they're turning 3. That does seem to happen a lot, that they do go on and get a diagnosis. So, not to take hope away from anyone, just to keep it pretty realistic. The other thing that I want to say about this, and then we're going to move on, and I say this, and I've said this, but I don't think I've ever said this on the show, social skill issues, you don't outgrow those. Sometimes with a language delay, a kid can not be talking, and then the maturation switch flips, and boy, he catches up pretty quickly, and you think, you know, thank you, God, for that. But these social skill issues, these are things that really don't go away without intervention. And so sometimes parents really do the whole wait and see, and I mean, I don't even advocate that for language, but I can almost understand that in that situation, in just a kid who everything developmentally is moving along great except expressive language. But when you have a kid who's not engaging and who doesn't consider consistently display the milestones that we've been talking about this last 4 weeks. That doesn't get better with time. And like you said, Kate, a lot of times those things get worse. It looks worse. And so this would be certainly be a case where you are not going to withhold any intervention, hoping that maturation will fix it, because maturation does not fix these kinds of issues. And as therapists, we should say that to parents who are on the fence about therapy. When I get emails through the website at teachmetotalk.com or whatever, someone's ordered a DVD and they're asking me my opinion, I always say we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know how children look, but social skills will be one area that just does not improve without focus and without intervention. I can't think of one kid that I can say that got better.
No.
Without doing something. And granted, now they're on our caseload, so we're naturally doing something. We don't have lots of experience with children who don't get therapy. But at the same time, you know, just from people that we know, just from our other lives and that we haven't worked with professionally, those kinds of things do tend to be magnified, those kinds of issues over time. So I wanted to throw that out there. I don't know that I've ever said it quite that way on the show, that you don't outgrow those kinds of social skill things. All right.
Right.
Any more? Do you want to say any more about social responses before we move on?
No, let's move on.
Okay.
Let's get through this topic.
The next skill would be that a child who's able to demonstrate turn-taking. And again, sometimes parents are confused about this, and they think that when we're talking about turn-taking, we're only talking about turns like during a board game or turns, you know, really obvious, like turn-taking during conversation. I talk, you talk, I talk, you talk. And again, our kids that we're usually talking about are nonverbal, so we're not even at the conversational level. And when we're discussing turn-taking in the context of looking at social skill development, we mean children usually who are doing it nonverbally. And so for a typically developing toddler, almost any kid that's turning 2 or 3 in the United States, if I hold out my open palm to them, they almost all, and say, give me 5, they almost all know what that means and will slap my hand and do it. That's an example of early turn-taking. Another example would be that you're playing with a child and you're pretending to feed a baby doll, and then the kid would try to feed you. Or a kid who's drinking from his sippy cup would think it's funny to try to make his mommy take a drink of the sippy cup. Or let's say a dad might honk a kid's nose, you know, just playing a honk honk or a beep beep and tap a kid's nose. We want the kid to reach back up and try to do that to dad. And so those would be examples of really typical early turn-taking abilities that we would see in toddlers. And for lots of our friends who are struggling with social skill development, we don't see any of that. There's none of that automatic reciprocity is the therapy term for that. That back and forth ability to just kind of play, even without a toy or even without a prop or anything, that they're just naturally going to engage in those back and forth little things for you. Waving bye-bye is an example where you wave and they automatically wave bye to you. Or, and again, even before a kid would say anything, you would see lots of evidences of him participating in interaction with you where it has a back and forth quality to it, so that you take a turn.
You know, Laura, I don't
turn,
think I ever really realized that's what was meant by turn taking. That's a bit of a revelation to me.
You must have slept through that.
I guess I did. I don't know what. I guess I would have thought more like a parent would have thought, like maybe not a game, but some sort of I do it, you do it, I do it, you do it. Not just a simple, because to me that, I mean, I'm not questioning it, I'm just saying to me that they have to somehow be able to imitate, you know, they have to see a wave, do a wave to somebody else. They have to give five back. They have to, a lot of it is based on a child's ability to imitate, and I don't think I really put two and two together and thought, well, yeah, that is kind of turn-taking, but I'm just calling myself out for not knowing that. So
I think if you trace it back it really begins there, between 6 and 12 months, and in those
right.
really early things, that early everyday routines that a kid learns how to do.
Typically developing kids have so many of those by 12
right.
months normally.
Right.
You know, you do patty cake, they do patty cake. You do
right.
so big, they do so big. And it's not
right.
hard to get most kids to do those things. I mean, if you
right.
look at them and smile and give them a little attention, they just light up and do
it. Eat it up. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's pretty automatic. And that's the piece that's missing. And it's, I mean, the imitation piece is what lots of researchers say is the core disruption for autism. That whole,
right.
because they can't imitate, they don't develop the gestures, they don't develop the play, they don't develop the language. You know, again, because that I know how to look at you and do what you do piece is disrupted. None of those other skills come in. And if even when you're looking at play, if you trace playback, the way that a baby learns how to do anything is because he or she has watched his mom or dad or her mom or dad or an older sibling or someone else do it first. I mean, babies probably don't just instinctively stack or instinctively nest the cups or whatever.
Right.
They watch somebody else do it first. And so
right.
those that I think about turn taking is being disrupted in that earliest phase, that then they never get to those other things because
right.
it never started. It didn't follow that whole sequence. So that's how I think about turn taking. And maybe I have started using different examples. That I don't know. I don't know. But that's how
I mean,
about it.
You know, like an early one that most typically developing kids adore and seem to have an instinct about is like any form of a simple peekaboo. Whether you hold up
right.
your hand and then peek your eyes out, or use a blanket, or you hide behind the
right.
wall, or they
right.
just love that. And I mean, how many kids in the grocery store sitting in the cart have you engaged in peekaboo? By hiding behind
yeah.
whatever you're holding in the checkout line, and they
uh-huh.
just love it and
they
start playing
it.
Right back.
Right.
Yeah, and I just thought, oh, that's imitation, but it is really kind of turn-taking, and I just never used that terminology before, so I knew that it was important, but I didn't really label it turn-taking. So I'm going to have to correct that in my repertoire.
Well, and really, and the basis for this is the whole imitation piece, and it's the social piece. I mean, they
right.
have to have the social instinct to
mm-hmm.
look at you long enough and to pay attention to you long enough to get to the imitation piece. Because so many
right.
of our kids, again, you know, always kind of my standard joke is, you know, it took me 45 minutes and I had to break out in a sweat before he knew that I was here. I had to do everything possible to get him to look at me and pay attention to me and want to be with me and smile at me and engage with me. And again,
mm-hmm.
it's that core piece that's disrupted, so you don't get to the turn-taking yet because
right.
the child is not able to watch you long enough to be able to do his part, which usually for all those things that we've talked about, it's, and like you said, it's imitating what they've seen the other person do. Excuse me.
But isn't it awesome when we do get them to where they're doing at least some of that? That's
yeah.
when we start
even
to
if
feel
it's,
so good.
Yeah, even if it's pretty canned or even
right.
if it's pretty robotic at the beginning, that's okay. And even, you know, if I have taken a kid's hand 25 times in 3 weeks and tried to teach him how to smack my hand back for give me five, and he finally reaches out like he's going to do it, you do feel like, oh, my goodness, we're getting somewhere. Woo! Progress!
We're
yeah,
making
so,
some progress now. It is huge because these are kids
yeah.
who don't necessarily respond regardless, and you have to do it and 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 do it, and do it until finally you see. And when they do it, that's when you see the twinkle that I'm so fond of referring to, because they know. You know what
right.
I mean? They get it. Like, I
part.
Get it. I'm going to give it
yeah.
back to you. And that's when you
right.
think, oh, we have a connection.
Yeah.
Even if
and
it took me 45
that,
minutes to get it,
yeah.
we have a connection.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
that's when you feel like, okay, now we have something to build on, you know.
Right. And all those examples that I gave, that would be how we elicit early turn-taking in therapy, even if you're doing hand-over-hand to get a kid to do it, even if it starts with Gimme Five, even if it starts with, you know, playing all of those social games that you mentioned, Pat-a-Gate, Peek-a-Boo, So Big, all of those fun, easy routines that typically developing babies play. And again, they learn those without lots of effort. Their parents play it a time or two, and boom, they have it. And so again, a lot of the kids that we're talking about don't have the experiences to and have never played that way because their parents, even if they did initiate it when they were younger, they didn't get the social response back, and so the parents stopped playing because on some level they think either A, he doesn't like it, which all kids should like those kinds of games. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. Typically developing children like those kinds of games, and if a child doesn't like it, that's a big red flag. And then the parents stop doing it and stop trying, or they don't know that for some children you have to work and work and work before you're going to get that kind of response that you would see. And because they're not therapists, they don't know to keep going with that kind of thing. Sometimes I'll have therapists say to me, he doesn't like those social games, so I'm not really going to play those with him. And I think, well, that's a big red flag to you if you're not going to play those with him. Gosh, and we just talked about a little guy like that, didn't we? We just had the same conversation. You know, that really lets you know that, I mean, socially and interaction-wise, he's got a big problem, that this is missing from him. So, you know, again, that would be a big diagnostic indicator to a therapist or to a parent that something has gone wrong and that the child is missing that really core skill and that whole social piece. And I was going a different direction with this, but I've forgotten what I was going to say. I got disrupted with my own little thought.
I don't know.
Oh, well, whatever. It'll come back to me or it won't. Anyway, let's move on. Oh, that's
okay.
What I was saying. All the examples that we gave, that's how you work on that in therapy. That's how you would work on that with your own child, or those examples. Hit rewind if you're listening to the show and you're thinking, oh, I missed it. I missed what I'm supposed to do therapy-wise to develop turn-taking. All those examples we gave, those would be things that you would work on with a kid who is not demonstrating that kind of turn-taking. There, I also wanted to mention the first therapy manual that I wrote, Teach Me to Play With You, is full of examples of play routines and those early little social routines and social games that we do with children. And it's written in a homework format so that a therapist can use it with a parent, or a parent can just get it for themselves and look at the directions for how to play those kinds of games with children and some ideas to try if those things aren't working, some ways that you can tweak the game, and then more importantly, some ways that you can expand the game once you start to get that connection with your child, how you can keep that going and work on that. And again, there's a chapter on those early play routines, and then there's some things on early toys, some routines that you can use for children who don't seem to notice people once the toys come out. Then there's a whole chapter on finger plays and songs and just some really good ideas. And I don't know if I had mentioned Teach Me to Play With You during our previous episodes, because if you're really struggling with, okay, I know there's a social problem with this kid, what am I going to do? Teach Me to Play With You will give you tons of good ideas for
tons. And I love the way it's written where you kind of say, if this doesn't work, try this. If you get this,
right,
try this. It's very,
right,
and I don't mean this in a negative way, cookbooky as far as very,
yeah,
specific, concrete examples,
right,
and suggestions and strategies, and I like that. So, because I think this,
yeah,
is obvious to you, it's certainly not obvious to every parent and or every therapist, and you're very good at breaking it down and making it as obvious as it could possibly be. So,
yeah, very simplistic, and it's not written in therapy lingo either. It's in plain adult everyday, and it's conversational, but at the same time, it is very easy to follow. You will not be intimidated by reading through those examples of things to do. And it is where you start when you're starting to look at all of these things. The whole laughing and smiling with you to get a social response, all those little games are supposed to elicit those kinds of responses too. And again, there's some different things that you can do, some strategies that you can try if that's not coming with the kid that you're working on. So Teach Me to Play with You is a great resource for parents and for therapists too. Therapists will like it because if you don't know what to do, the ideas are there. But the best part about that book is that you can copy the sheet and give it to a parent for homework, or a caregiver, or a grandparent, and say, this is what we're working on, this is what I want you to do. And again, it's written in terms that anybody can follow it. It's like a homework guide. So hopefully that'll be some help to people. Okay, the next skill, let's move on. It's using simple and purposeful gestures. And so even before children talk, and this would be even for children who are late talkers, but that's all that's going on with them, all of those children that I would really consider just to have an expressive language delay, their comprehension is good, their social skills are great, cognitively they're doing great, all that's missing would be the words. Those children are still communicating a lot with their parents. They just aren't doing it with words yet. They're using lots and lots of gestures. So when we see a child who is beyond 12, 15 months, who has not figured out how to make my mommy know what I want her to do, even without words, and again, this wouldn't be the mom just reading the kid's mind. This would be the kid is working, and we're going to talk about this in a second, but initiating and working to get the mom's attention. And then using gestures to let mom know what I want. And this would be even without words. And that's, again, the mark that a lot of therapists miss is how do I distinguish a kid who's just a late talker from a child who has a more global developmental delay? Gestures are one thing that you look at. If you have a child who's not, and I'm not just talking about pointing. I mean, pointing is the most obvious one, and boy, do we have a lot of kids on our caseloads who cannot point.
Right.
But even other gestures, like clapping when something is fun or when they're excited, or, you know, with the Wheel of Fortune clappers, you know, on there, or, you know, anytime they hear clapping, that's one thing that really lets me start to know that a kid is starting to get it in therapy, is when I clap and say, yay, you know, which I do ad nauseum in a session. When a kid starts to really do that, that's when I start to think, all right, now we're getting somewhere. You know, not only did he light up and twinkle, but he clapped with me.
Right.
You know, and
how about when they start doing it before you do? I always love that, too.
I love it.
Hey, you forgot
yeah.
to clap. That's what I always take that as a little reminder I'm not being responsive or fun enough. I'm like, you're right. I haven't given you your due credit. Let me give you a big yay for that.
Let's stop for praise. Yeah.
Yeah,
but those kinds of things, and I think we talked about this a few weeks ago on the show, but I'm going to say it again. It's the absence of that early symbolism or symbolic development that lets you know that he or this kid is not ready for language, because language, words are just symbols. It's abstract. It's just a ball is not really a ball. I mean, it's a ball, but we just call it ball because that's our symbol. That those sounds are what we know in English mean, that, you know, that round toy that you can bounce and throw and kick. It's not, it's the symbol. And so when a child isn't using gestures in that way, symbolically, meaning I'm going to wave when you wave, and that means that you or I are about to leave, or clapping for excitement, or pointing to mean I want that, or look at that for attention. When a child isn't using those early gestures symbolically, we know that cognitively he is not ready to learn language yet, because he's not mastered any kind of symbol that would be a lot easier than talking. And so that's a big, big, big thing that we look for. And so many of our children who are on the spectrum who have these social skill issues only get those, what I started calling, functional gestures. They might lead you, or they might push you or pull you, or like we talk about, Kate, the big hand theory. You know, I know to take my mommy's hand to make her push this toy because it happens faster if she does it. That's that's a functional gesture. That's not a symbolic gesture. So when we are analyzing a child's gestures, we need to look for those that really mean something else. And that's how we use sign language. That's why we teach children to use signs, you know, to put their fingers together to say more, or to hold one palm out and put the other set of fingers in the palm to make the symbol that we all recognize as cookie or anything like that. And so if when you have a child that's not waving and clapping and pointing or doing any of those really early gestures, he's not ready to sign yet. He's not ready to use words yet because he doesn't have, he's not an abstract thinker yet. Cognitively, he's not there. And again, this would be the exception for this would be that children who have motoric problems but who cognitively are moving along, and I'll just say those children are rare, because usually
right.
when we're looking at them in early intervention and everybody wants to see the glass half full and you have a kid whose body is not cooperating, and somehow we still tend to give them credit for things cognitively that they have never shown us that they can do or understand. And that
right.
happens a lot in early intervention, where we go in and kids aren't able to play and they're not doing any of these gestures or any of these things that would indicate that, but somehow we think that their comprehension is okay. And that just is the exception rather than the rule. And people, I see that all the time. People mistakenly assume that. And then they try to get children to use all of these complicated assistive augmentative communication devices when they are in no way, shape, or form ready for any of that. Or they'll start a picture system. And you think, a picture system, he hasn't mastered very basic concrete things in play. How do you think he's going to know that the picture of this cup means he wants a cup? And so you've got to really look at what kids are telling you that they understand and what level they're ready to communicate at. And oftentimes we take it up 5 or 6 levels beyond where it should be just based on what a kid's telling us in play that he can or can't do. Does that make sense?
It does to me. You know, another early one, Laura, that I'm always happy to see, and I don't recall whether my kids did this or not. I think it's a pretty, not completely universal, but I think kids who get gestures oftentimes have this one. I call it the gimme fingers.
Yeah.
When they're reaching for something, you have something, you know, and they have an interest in it, and they get their little hands, and they just kind of open and close, like,
yeah.
Gimme, gimme, gimme.
Yeah.
Hence the gimme fingers logo that I use with that. But, I mean, I'm always thrilled when I see kids do that. Because
I'm totally
thrilled. Yes.
They're not
Ooh,
just
you get
reaching
that.
For it. Yeah, it's
right.
not just reaching. It's the whole act of saying, I want it, I want it, I want it, with opening and closing their hands. Macy was my, you know, out of my 3 children, Macy, oh, boy, did she have gimme fingers. We
yeah.
all 4 of us called it that for her because it was so blatantly obvious that that's what she was doing. She wasn't just
mm-hmm.
reaching for something to grab it out of your hand. Boy, she was working those little fingers to say, I want it to her. I want it. I want it. I want it. Give it to me. Give it to me. Yeah, so that's a good one. I have a good list of those kinds of gestures and how to teach those in Teach Me to Talk, the therapy manual. I'm looking at it right now. It's on page 131. And so it's written for, again, for a therapist to be able to copy this page and say to a parent, we're going to work on teaching these kinds of gestures. Because, again, until a child learns that he can control his world, I can do these things and get results, and until a kid can do these really basic, easy things, he's really not developmentally ready to learn to move on to use a lot of words communicatively, or certainly not an advanced system like a picture system or even a computer that would talk for him, some of those fancy schmancy systems. And again, sometimes therapists really get so far ahead of themselves, or a mom will see something really cool and she'll think, boy, we're going to work on this. And I'm not knocking those things, and I'm not saying that those things don't have a place, because when you're really looking prognostically at a kid and saying, you know, spoken language may never be a reality for him, that's when I start to think about, okay, boy, we better start looking at an AAC system here that can go with this kid. But even before that happens, you've got to make sure that cognitively that they had these other things coming in, because if not, you're wasting time. And a lot of times you're wasting money, too. When how many times do we see in state early intervention systems, Kate, and certainly, and you know, not on our caseloads because we're not going to let this happen, but from where we might be replacing another therapist or coming into a team new, and they've spent a whole lot of money getting a kid, and this used to happen more.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, it doesn't
happen
much anymore because now the system won't pay for it. In the good old
right.
days, if a therapist said this was indicated, there weren't really any questions asked, and there were a lot of instances of people getting, and, you know, anything quote-unquote therapeutic is, what, 10 times what you think it
right.
would cost?
Right.
You know, oh, this is a different subject. But anyway, yes, it used to happen all the time, and now the system has really cracked down on buying all those big time things, and in a way it's good because it did happen.
In a way,
think,
it is
what
good.
What in the world? The mom doesn't
yeah.
even know how to use it, let alone the kid.
And then it sits in a corner, and you think how
mm-hmm.
many thousands of dollars were wasted with the system. And again, I'm not knocking those things for the kids who really need it and for the parents who really need it. And again, for kids who that's going to be their long-term solution. And oh gosh, we worked with a little girl several years ago whose mom was fabulous at implementing that kind of thing. But, you know, you always have to go back to what basic skills does the kid need before that system would really even work for him or her, and learning the symbolism of, okay, if I push this button, that picture or whatever word that device said for me is what I'm going to get. And a lot of times, you know, that would be that a kid's master cause and effect. And a lot of times we see those systems put in place for, one, kids who don't understand what those pictures mean, certainly don't know what the words are, or that are just, they don't know cause and effect. They just know they push the button, but they don't really care what happens after that. And so
mm-hmm.
You have to still address the skills and make sure that cognitively the kid is there and aware, and or that you're working toward that, knowing that that's realistic for a kid to get there and for that system to be really functional. I feel like I've gone off kind of in a different direction. We're supposed to be talking about gestures here. But same thing. It's symbolism. And until a kid understands that in the most fundamental way, he or she is not really ready to move beyond that developmentally. And that's like I always say, if a kid can't clap, how in the world do you expect him to be able to sign more? Because if he doesn't even have the motor skills, to bring his hands to midline, how can we expect that he can do that for a sign when we don't see it in a simpler form or a more simple form, whatever the correct grammar is with that word? If we don't see it there, how can we expect him to be able to know that and learn that I can put my fingers together for more when he hasn't really mastered the easier motor skill of clapping first and of knowing that means, yay, I'm excited, I'm happy. So that's my whole point with that we have to look at gestures and how kids are using those. And if they don't have them, teach them. Let that be part of your therapy goal. And teach mom and dad how to use those gestures and how waving bye-bye is important. It is something that we see typically developing babies do by the time their first birthdays roll around. So if you have a 2-year-old on your caseload that's not doing that, you could spend a lot of time working on him or her understanding more complicated words when you might be wasting your time. And we'd
you
be
know
better
what the help
working
says on that, Laura?
What?
On waving? I've always thought this is pretty young. I think it probably is accurate for typically developing kids, but that's not my area of practice. So, but the Hawaii Early Learning Profile says 7 to 9 months for waving.
I believe it.
Mm-hmm.
With a typically developing kid. And so that's my, you know, saying 12 months old, that's very generous. So if you have a 2-year-old that's not doing that.
And we get a lot of kids.
That's the problem.
18,
yeah.
20, 22, 24 months, they don't wave, they don't point. They don't
right.
clap. They don't do any of those gestures. It's pretty common. And, you know, my autism sensor is always kind of going up when I get a child that age who isn't doing any of the above. I mean, that's
exactly.
not always a guarantee, but am I starting to wonder already? Because I asked that on day one. Does he wave? Does he point?
Yeah.
Does he clap?
Right.
Does he use any other gestures to, well, and usually if the answer is no to that, a lot of times you'll hear, well, he does take me to what he wants.
Right.
You know, and that's the old hand. I'll get the hand and pull the body
right.
with it. And that's kind of how
again,
they do it, too.
And that's functional, and that's
mm-hmm.
we're not knocking that. I mean, you certainly
right.
want to see that on some level he's learned that. But it's not symbolic. And the reason that symbolic gestures are important, let me just say it one more time in case someone slept through my last little dissertation on that. It's because it's a precursor to being able to use words, and words are symbols. And you can't, if when you're using a word, you are using symbolic communication when you say a word. And so if you can't use a gesture, like gestures usually come first. And so if you're not understanding or a kid is not understanding how to use a gesture to convey meaning, then he's 99.99999% of the time not ready to learn to use words yet. Because you've got to have, you usually see any skill that we see with language, we usually see demonstrated nonverbally first, meaning that if a kid, that's why receptive language, that's why children, typically developing kids, understand more than they can say. They usually understand that book, when mom says, go get a book, long before they can say book, they know that what book means, and mommy reads that to me, and we look at this together, or I look at it by myself, or whatever. They understand it before they can say it. So they've demonstrated to you, nonverbally, that they understand that word, usually before you hear that word pop out of their little mouths. And so you take that, back it up a step further for looking at these gestures. If you have a kid who's not using these gestures yet, that tells you he's not developing symbolism. If you're looking at language as a cognitive behavior, and the longer I do this, boy, the more I look at it that way, he's telling you, I'm not ready for this yet. I haven't mastered a way to use anything symbolically. And so you start by looking at these gestures. Again, if you're a therapist and need some help on that, Teach Me to Talk, the therapy manual, will teach you how to look at it that way. And more importantly, teach you how to teach parents how to look at it that way, so that you're working on what you should be working on and not getting too far ahead of yourself there. Okay, we're at the end of our hour, and Kate, we did three tonight, so we only have three more social skills next week that we need to talk about. And I am confident that we will wrap it up next week. If we can get it down to
three,
I think we can
finish
it.
We're going to really commit to that goal.
But next week is really the three things that we're going to talk about next week really build on what we talked about tonight. So it's taking those social skills and a step further, kind of the next little realm of skills that we look at. So next week, that's where we'll pick up and hopefully finish our series. And who knew this would be a 5-week series when we started 4 weeks ago. So.
Wow, we do digress quite a bit on this topic. But you know what, Laura, all kidding aside, after our first one where we went on for way longer than we thought on just a couple of the social skills,
right?
You got emails from parents that basically said, gee, if I hadn't listened to that, I wouldn't have even known that it was
right.
an issue. And it
right.
was because we went on and on and on. And I hope that
right.
even though we probably turned off some listeners by going on and on tonight, there may be a mom or a dad or a grandma or some loving soul out there thinking, oh, I never thought of it that way. I never really knew to be concerned about that. It wasn't until you said, fill in the blank, and so there is some merit and worth to going on ad nauseum about little points and giving our little scenarios.
Well, and really, I love that we help parents that way, but every week I get emails from therapists who say, thank goodness I'm listening to your show, because I've learned
mm-hmm.
more from that show than I ever read in a book, than I ever heard in grad school, you know, than I ever, whatever. And I know therapists use this as a tool. And maybe it's, you know, again, as I was saying something to you tonight, I said, boy, we just had this conversation this week. I mean, these are all highly relevant topics to therapists who work with birth to 3-year-olds. So I am sure that we have helped some therapists clinically too. If nothing,
I'm
just
sure
to realize, oh my goodness, I've not paid enough attention to that, or I
well,
never
and it
thought
isn't
about
something that's
yeah.
really taught in a
right.
cohesive, organized,
straightforward.
Fashion. Yes, it really isn't.
Right.
It should be, and you're the one
it
doing
be.
It. But in general, academic, I mean. Certainly not with my master's in early childhood education was this anything that we really addressed at all.
But
so,
here's
and
the
I
problem.
Suspect even in,
it,
go ahead.
Oh yeah, and I was going to say, it's okay, these things are taught in graduate-level speech pathology classes, but they're not explained. And so you might
right.
get a list like this, and or therapists read this kind of list on an autism checklist, but they're not really clear on A, what it looks like when they're seeing a real live kid in a real live appointment, or B, how to explain it to parents so that parents understand what they're talking about. And so
mm-hmm.
what happens is the therapist tries to use professional lingo, and I see them talking themselves in a circle when they're doing it, and I think, you don't know what you're talking about right now. But the mom doesn't know that you don't know what you're talking about because you're throwing in enough language to confuse her and yourself. You know, you don't even know. And so that's why talking about it in real-life examples, and that's another thing that you were bringing up, too, is parents will say, gosh, you described my kid perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But you start to recognize these patterns, and it again, we have the benefit of seeing hundreds and thousands of kids and seeing it over and over and over and over with a pattern, and a parent hasn't seen that yet, or a new therapist hasn't worked long enough to see that, or even an older therapist who hasn't paid enough attention in the last 20 years to recognize that there's a pattern there, or to really kind of go beyond the checklist and think, what does this really mean? How does a kid who's having trouble connecting, what does that mean? How can I tease that out? Or sometimes
mm-hmm.
you know it, but you just don't know how to explain it or how to talk about it. And so I know that we've helped therapists with this show too. So, or I think so anyway.
I
All
believe
right.
we have. I guess I am particularly touched by the parents who write it. I think, oh, it was worth it then if one parent listened and,
yeah.
you know.
Oh, and yeah. Oh, and I get touched by that too. And yeah. And I guess I get an equal number of emails from parents from
therapists. And therapists. Yeah.
Yeah. And because I'm doing the conferences, and I think people, I don't know, sometimes I just want to hug somebody and say, I can't believe you were that darn honest. I can't believe you just told me that. When they'll say, I didn't know any of that until today. And they
uh-huh.
look at me, and I know they're telling me the truth. And so
mm-hmm.
for every person who drops the facade long enough to tell me that or email me that,
uh-huh.
I know that there are X number who can't say that or who won't say that or who would never share that. And
mm-hmm.
so I know that we're doing that too. So anyway, all right. Well, I think our show has come to an end.
Okay.
Next week we're going to pick up talking about those last three social skill indicators, and we'll hopefully wrap the series up. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thank you. Bye.
Talk to you later. Bye.